Janeway, Fox, Spear, Locke is acting very weird. Captain Pike, Sisko's wife, Klingons and the afterlife. Boimler, Tendi's dog, Ransom is very hard. Spore Drive, Black Alert, Giorgio has gone berserk. Teacher bad left, Edward is an idiot. Spock is dead, Worf is wed, Chekhov's wearing red. Data's cat, Kempak sat, Q has had enough of that. Beam me up, make it so, everybody let's go.
We talk about the series. You can join us live by picking up your phone now. We talk about the series. We're coming to you on your streaming services now. We talk about the series.
You know, those pesky little tribbles, they get into everything, don't they, guys? You gotta watch them. They're everywhere. They get into the circuitry. They get into everything and cause all kinds of problems. Hey, guys, welcome to the show. It is March 14th, 2024. It is 7:30 p.m. Eastern time or 4:30 p.m. Pacific time. That means we are live, and that means you guys can let your fingers do the walking and call Trek Talking right now, and you're definitely going to want to do that because we have a great guest who would love to take some questions from you. He's a screenwriter, a novelist, an actor. He, I think, has been around Star Trek probably almost as long as Gene Roddenberry. Would you guys not agree? I think, he's been around Star Trek for a very, very, very long time. And he's here to take your questions, and I'm talking about the none, the only, the man, the myth, the legend himself, Mr. David Gerald. He's going to be on the line in just a second. So give us a call, 646-668-2433, to have your questions ready. I'm your most excellent host, Uncle Jim. And before we get started, I want to go around and introduce all of my Trexperts. And we'll start off with Andy. Andy's a special Trexpert tonight, and he's calling in from Tennessee. How you doing, Andy?
I'm doing great. It's spring here in Tennessee, and you can tell because the moment you go out, you get swarmed by bugs.
Wow, I look forward to that. I'm looking forward to the bugs. Believe me, I am. And we also have
looking forward to spring all year.
Yes, it's almost here. We have Charles. Charles is out in Las Vegas. How you doing tonight, Charles?
I'm good. Happy Pi Day to all my Trekkies as we're in windblown Vegas.
Lots of pie. Today is a good day to pie. I think Worf said that, didn't he? Or something very similar. And we're going to swing over to Portland. We're going to spin the globe all the way over to Portland where I have my triple play, my trifecta of Trexperts. And we'll start off with David the Donut Guy. How you doing tonight, David?
Yeah, pretty good, pretty good. Really warm over here now since springtime's about to approach and tribbles are falling from the sky. So watch out for you people who have allergies.
You want to hear something really strange? Thing? You guys are all talking about spring. Up here in Vermont, we just had a snowstorm just last weekend. I was coming back from Massachusetts.
Isn't that Vermont spring, though?
We had up at Pico Mountain, they had a foot of snow. I'm driving over the mountain to come back into Rutland. I'm like, oh, my God, this can't be happening. But by the time I got down the mountain.
That's a balmy foot of snow.
Yes, you go out and you open up your pool and you put on your T-shirt and you go out for a stroll and enjoy it. So I am looking forward to the bugs.
That's all right. I think our mountain just got a snowstorm a bunch of snow this morning.
Yeah, once the snow ends up in Vermont, it doesn't want to go away. It wants to stay. So yeah, we'll deal with it. And also from Portland, we have our very own Eric. How you doing tonight, Eric?
I am doing quite well. I am very excited about our guest tonight. And, I enjoyed a little bit of time outside here in that nice weather David was talking about. What a great day. Ugh, love spring.
Oh,
love spring.
It was a beautiful day, beautiful day. And last but not least, also in Portland, we have our very own Paul the Toy Guy. How you doing tonight, Paul?
You know, I'm doing good, Uncle Jim, but man, you guys really like to talk about the weather. That is the guaranteed go-to intro subject that you dudes like to chat about every week. It blows my mind, man. I'm waiting for the weather map and the green screen and a chance of a low pressure area coming in from out of the northeast. It's like wild stuff.
I've got a green call. I can do that.
I'm not going to Tennessee after your endorsement there, man. With all the bugs and whatnot, I'm like, I'm out. I just can't do it. You do not want to work for the Tennessee Tourist Department. I'll tell you that.
You can see them just parked on the wall waiting to harass me the moment I come out.
It's like Stephen King.
Waiting for me to come out.
It's like Stephen King's The Mist. It's like, I'm not going anywhere near there. It's just not
exactly
happening.
Like,
but, guys, we have a Hugo and Nebula Award-winning writer on our show tonight. I mean, I'm kind of, like, giddy with excitement, like Eric said. I mean, this is super exciting. So I'm eager to get past the preliminaries and dig in, throw on the fandom lobster bib. Let's get cracking.
Heck, yeah. We've got to ask David about the weather.
Yeah, we got to find out.
Hey.
Don't do it. Don't go there. So, guys, you can head over to our Facebook page, or you can go to TrekTalkin.com, and that will take you to our Facebook page. And at the top of our Facebook page is a pinned post saying, hey, dude, where are you listening from? Drop us a line, leave lots of emojis. If you see a heart next to your name from yours truly, Uncle Jim, then you want to tune in to next week's show because you are going to be mentioned on a fan shout-out, and then the whole world will know that you're not only a Star Trek fan, but that you listen to one of the best number 22 podcasts on the hottest list of podcasts, Trek Talking. So, Eric, you want to get us started with our fan shout-outs?
Yeah, sure. This week we're saying hello to top fan Dino Monzone, who's saying hello to us from Makati City in the Philippines. Definitely getting Jim's attention with that beautiful Philippine flag flying there, Dino. Thank you so much for supporting the podcast. Top fan status means you interact a ton with us on our Facebook page, and we really appreciate that. So live long and prosper to you. Luciano Puda, we're saying hello to you, and you are saying hello to us from Como, Italia, a country that I am not too long away from visiting here. I'm going to be in Roma, but Como is also a very beautiful area. Luciana, thank you so much for saying hello to us, and live long and prosper to you. Robert Bratu is also saying hello to us from Bucharest in Romania, another beautiful country with tons of good food and tons of amazing people. Robert Bratu, thank you for saying hello this week. And top fan Kat Smith is saying hello to us this week from Otago, New Zealand. Kat Smith from Otago, New Zealand, all the way on the other side of the globe. Thank you so much for saying hello. Charles, I'm going to spin that globe over to you, brother.
Oh, thank you, Eric. Let's start off with a top fan, Judy DeChant from Kingston, Tennessee, giving us a smiley face and the USA flag. Welcome, Judy. Welcome to Juanita Ruth Moore Grider from Lynn, Indiana, and says engage. Welcome to Craig Steenholm from Muskegon, Michigan. Not familiar with that one. And then finally, a welcome to Sandy Douglas, right here in Las Vegas. I don't recognize you, Sandy, but you ought to come check out the USS Las Vegas for the Windrunner. Then I'll send over to Paul and see who is in the U.S.
I think, is it David up next, or did I get confused?
David, sorry, David.
Oh, it's me, yeah. Okay, hey. So,
sorry, got my names mixed up today.
I would like to welcome a top fan from Los Angeles, California, saying hello to Angel Aragon Solis. Welcome. And another welcome to Jose Clark from Midland, Texas. I got another hello welcome to somebody from North Carolina, USA, named of Rita Stein Schwartz. Welcome. And the last one on my list is a warm welcome to Brian Mabry from Fort Worth, Texas. And that's all I have. So, Paul, who's on your list?
Thanks, David. You know, I love whenever we get to do this every week, it's just such a great reminder that we're an international community, right? I mean, we hear so much about how the world is divided and there's so many things that we keep, you know, keep us separated from each other. But this is a reminder we all have a lot in common, that there are Star Trek fans all over the planet. Beyond the good old U.S. of A., here are fans all over Europe. Let's say hello to fan Vladislav Stefanov, saying hello and live long and prosper from Bulgaria. Amazing part of the continent over there. Bulgaria is like midway sandwich between like Romania and Turkey, pretty much, if my memory serves there. But an amazing spot of the world. Great to hear from you, Vladislav, and thank you so much for sharing your enthusiasm for Star Trek with us. Got a couple of top fans queuing into the lobby here. We've got top fan Roland Jimenez Gutierrez here, who is saying hello from the capital of Uruguay, from Montevideo. Amazing, gorgeous coastal area of South America, basically right next door to Buenos Aires there, but amazing spot. And of course, Uruguay is the capital that we have there. So a bustling, exciting metropolis, flag displayed proudly, Roland. So top fan status, as most of us know, means you're on our Facebook page a lot, interacting with us and spreading your enthusiasm for all the latest and greatest that is Star Trek. And there's always more coming very soon. We're going to jump across a couple of oceans here. We'll go to Blarney, Cork, Ireland. We're going to say to another top fan, Carl Horgan is saying hello there from Blarney. So that's a storied, very magical part of the island there. So really great to hear from you, Carl. And thank you so much for being such an enthusiastic fan of this show and of all things Star Trek. And then finally, let's go back over to Europe, the continent once again. Flags flying with great enthusiasm. It's our friend Johanna Gerzalak from Poland that we have there. Hello, Johanna, and it's wonderful to be able to say live long and prosper to you, my friend. And thanks for reminding us that we all have a lot more in common than we do things that we have dividing us. So lovely to hear from you all. Let's pass this longitudinal, latitudinal seasickness machine over to Jim.
Well, thank you so much, Paul. We've got four more fan shout-outs, and then we're going to get to our main event. So let your fingers do the walk, and then call Trek Talk and get on the line right now. 646-668-2433 is the number. It'll be no trouble at all to get you on, I promise. All right, guys. I want to say hello and thank you to top fan Eric F. Dunn, who's listening to us in Brooklyn, New York, sends us a thumbs up and a rocket ship. Thank you for listening, Eric. We also want to say thank you to Marcellus Beasley, who's listening to us in New Jersey, USA, and sends us an American flag. Thank you, Marcellus. We also want to say thank you to Alex Wilson, who's listening to us in Massachusetts. I was just there on Saturday. Thank you for being a fan, Alex. And last, but definitely not least, I want to say thank you to Jeff Byrne, who's listening to us in Denver, Colorado. And that, my friends, is our fan shout-outs. Please head over to our Facebook page and tell us where you're from and look for a heart next to your name from yours truly, Uncle Jim, and we will get you on. So without any further ado, it's SP Tribbles again. Oh, my God. You guys want to call in because we have with us a legend, a Star Trek legend himself, Mr. David Gerald. How you doing, David?
I'm fine. Can you hear me?
Absolutely.
Hello. All right,
yes,
great.
We can hear you now. So,
all right,
you know,
wonderful.
I wanted to ask you, you are living in my neck of the woods now. So what did you find about living up here that's different? What do you think about it?
It's quieter and there's less traffic, and and it's I think we're something like 23 miles from the nearest McDonald's, so there's no more late night stress eating.
No, you are quite far from McDonald's, that is for sure. And you were just up at the Star Trek set.
The interesting thing is. Yeah, the interesting thing is that every day the weather is different. So every day the view changes. And I mean, it's like, as you mentioned earlier, we had snowstorm over the weekend and, you know, 2-3 inches of snow. And then the next day, nothing. It had all melted and gone away. So it's every day is different here. And I kind of appreciate the novelty of never knowing what to expect.
Yeah, you never know until you walk out the door in the morning what it's going to be like.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
That's what happens here. But McDonald's, yeah, very far away. Burger King, Wendy's, Taco Bell, they're very, very far
away. Well, I don't miss it. Yeah, I don't miss it. We're under a lot of stress in L.A. just from a lot of different things, and so there was a lot of late night stress eating. And since moving here, I've lost about 30 pounds. Actually, I gained 6 of it back, but because I was traveling and people were taking me out to dinner, but I'm losing it again. So I'm great.
Now your nearest neighbor is what? 6 miles away?
God, I hope so. No, actually where we are is we have, I would say about a dozen neighbors within walking distance. So, and they're all good people. So you're not going to see a block party in this neck of the woods. No,
definitely not for sure. So, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for taking time to talk with us. We really appreciate it. And I wanted to start off as a kid, I would run home from school and I would watch Land of the Lost religiously. It was like my favorite show growing up, the claymation dinosaurs, the, you know, all of that stuff. And you actually came up with the sleaze stacks for Land of the Lost.
More than that, actually, I saw Marty Croft just before the strike. And we were talking about the possibilities of rebooting the show, which is still wide open. But we haven't had any further conversation since the strike. And, of course, Marty passed away just a couple months ago, and it was a tough blow. His daughter is a wonderful person and wonderful producer, and we had lunch and a meeting about the possibilities of Land of the Lost. But one of the things Marty said, he says, David, you created the show for us. You created it. We can't do it without you, which I think was an enormous compliment. And it's one of the reasons I loved and respected Marty so much is he respected the people who worked with him on all his shows, and he treated everybody like family. I could not go in for a meeting without them handing me a bunch of swag just for, you know, it's like, oh, here's some Land of the Lost socks. Here's a lunchbox. Do you have a complete set of the DVDs? Here's this. And it's like, I don't need all that, but I love it. You know, it's like, so I'm right now I'm wearing my Sleestak socks, but I created the Sleestaks. I created the Lost City. I created the pylons. And pretty much Sid had presented a picture book where he says they go to this Land of the Lost and there's this and this and this, but he had no story. And I said, okay, well, the giant insects are going to be a production problem, so we're not going to do those. And I'm not going to do the mystery man because he's too much like Tarzan, and that's a conflict of interest for me. But I'd love to do the dinosaurs, and I'm going to give you a Lost City, and we're going to have some lizard men, and I haven't figured out what to call them yet. I'll come up with something. And it all fell together, and we had, I can only say good things about Wesley and Kathy and Philip, who played Chaka. They brought such enthusiasm to it, and we had three USC basketball players who were already like 7 feet tall, and the Sleestak costumes added another foot to the crest, and we put them on foot-high stilts, so they were 9 foot tall Sleestaks. They were pretty terrifying even to, you know, and I'm a tall guy, and it's like they're pretty terrifying walk on the set, and the Sleestak comes lumbering over, hello, David. It was great.
I loved that show, David. That was one of my favorite shows growing up. And I actually liked the new movie with Will Ferrell as well. I thought that was funny.
Well, then you're one of the few because everybody else wanted more Land of the Lost. But I got a call. I haven't seen it. And then I got a call from Harlan Ellison who said, I just saw the When Land and Lost movie. I had a great time. You should go see it. So I did.
Yeah, I thought it was funny. I enjoyed it.
It wasn't a bad movie, but we wanted more of the seriousness of the Land of the Lost, and they played it for a comedy, which was okay, but I wanted to do a serious show. And so when I talked with Marty and Brianna and Rob, I said, let's get serious about this, and here's how I would do it. And they said, oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, it was different. So I wanted to ask you about Star Trek the Motion Picture. Now I know that you were in that scene at the beginning on the holodeck on the crew deck. What was it like?
Yeah.
What was it like to be on that first motion picture with everybody for the first time back together?
Well, you'll notice I'm speechless. It was amazing because there was a budget there to do a big set and show the whole crew. And there was a casting call with Robert Wise and a bunch of other people. And a lot of fans, LA fans, were invited to show up. And, of course, I had already been guaranteed by Gene. So Robert Wise said, David, relax. There were people who were not physically fit, a little too tall or too short or too fat or too thin, because they wanted the crew of Enterprise to look good. And then we all showed up on the Monday morning, and it was rough because the night I was coming back from San Francisco, and we stopped to visit Robert A. Heinlein, and it was going to be a short visit, and we ended up spending a lot of time, he and Ginny invited us to stay for dinner, and I certainly wasn't going to say no to Robert. And so then we had to drive all the way back from Bonnie Doon, and I arrived just in time. I didn't get any sleep. I went to the soundstage directly early because we had to get all costumed up and made up, and they had a whole assembly line of people putting people into costumes and then makeup and hair, and then those who were doing special makeup of all kinds. And I was very lucky. My makeup was done by V. Neil, who later won an Oscar, and she's just a marvelous person anyway. The costumes, you needed help getting in and out of them because the zippers were all in the back. So if you were going to go to the bathroom, you had to have someone go with you. And there were no shortage of volunteers. I have to go to the bathroom, and six women raised their hand. I was like, okay. But the interesting thing was we're all, the assistant directors put us into place. And am I too loud? I'm sorry. Okay. So anyway, I'm a little too loud. I'm waking the kids, so I have to lower my voice. So the assistant directors put us all into place because it was all Star Trek fans. No fan wanted to be the one who ruined the shot. So they got everything in like two takes, right? And so Robert Wise had scheduled for 2 days of shooting, and he was done like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Everything he needed, he got. And he was amazed at how professional and how enthusiastic the Star Trek fans were for that wonderful day of shooting. And then after that, there were a few moments where Bill Shatner posed with Bijo Trimble and myself and a couple others because they wanted publicity photos. I have a shot of me in uniform with Captain Kirk. And I know Bijo got some shots, and I know that Bill was a little, oh, God, do I have to take pictures? Yes, Bill, you do. he's mellowed out quite a bit. I mean, it's a hard job when you're the star of the show and you have all these responsibilities. I don't begrudge him being tired from the work he was doing. He had to be there very early to be into makeup. But I think one of the best moments of that entire experience was the entire cast was there lined up with Bill, and you would hear Scotty and Bones and Spock. No, I don't think Spock was there yet in the movie. Anyway, but everybody was there, and it was kind of awe-inspiring for those of us who are big fans of the show to see Bill and Dee and George and Jimmy and Walter and Grace and Michelle all together again. And then, of course, later on, we picked up Spock. So we didn't get to see Spock that day. But it was a fun shoot. And then when David Fine and his team have put together a special edition, edited the way Bob Wise had wanted it to be, and it's now on DVD and Blu-ray, and I think 4K as well. And there was a special screening at Paramount last year of the, and it's the first screening, and everybody who was a big Star Trek fan was there. James Colley from the Trek Experience in Ticonderoga, and a lot of people from all over who just showed up for that special screening. The Paramount Theater was full, and we actually had a great Star Trek night where we got to just be Star Trek fans all over again. And the revised, recut, re-edited version of the movie flows a lot better, and it's just all the effect shots were completed and restored, and the movie just looks great. So if you have a chance to pick up the restored edition, that's to me, that's the official one.
That was a very excellent version of the movie for sure. Speaking of James Colley, what did you think about the original set tour up in Ticonderoga? You got a chance to tour it, correct?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I've been a friend of James Colley's for, I don't know, it must be 20 years now. And we shot a film, Blood and Fire, there, which is available on YouTube. And he got in touch with me last year and said, there's some projects we want to do. And I said, well, I'm moving to Vermont, so I'm not going to be that far from you. So last month I went over to the set when Bill was there, and did the set tour with Bill, and I provided some stories that he hadn't heard, and he provided a lot of great information. The fans had a great time. And the set tour was more complete than I'd ever seen it before. I'd seen an earlier version of it when they first moved into that building. But now all the pieces are working, and the view screens work, and the communicators work, and the Tantalus thing slides up in Kirk's quarters, and all of the, there's all kinds of little pieces, and it is the most accurate recreation of the Star Trek sets that has ever been built, down to the millimeter. Don't take my word for it. Mike Okuda knows, and a few other people have been there. All of the actors who've been there are just awestruck by how accurate it is. And so a couple weekends ago, James asked me to do a couple of the tours of the set, and we had a big crowd, and it played so well, it worked so well, he's asked me to come back on April 13th and lead some more tours. So, and I love doing it. It's great fun because I get to share all of the anecdotes of the things I saw on the Star Trek set. And then I get to meet the fans of the show who have their stories to tell of what Star Trek meant, or how it changed their lives, or what they're up to now because of Star Trek. So the show is a phenomenon that no other television show has quite achieved the same impact on its audience, because it says we can, and I'm quoting Gene Roddenberry here, the way things are is not the way they have to be. And you can see that in the expressions of the Star Trek fans. And we had it's just a great fun to spend time with other. See, I don't see, you know, you guys introduce me sometimes as this living legend or this luminary, which I disavow. I'm not a guru. I'm just a guy who sits alone in a room and talks to himself and types up the good stuff. And I'm just a fan like everybody else. So when you invite me to do the Star Trek tour or whatever, it's like I get to share the fun we've had with other people who want to hear about it. So it's great.
Well, speaking of being a legend, you actually came up with James T. Kirk's middle name, correct?
Yes, I did. I had
You're
been reading a book about – yes, I did. I had been reading a book about the Roman emperors, and the only one worse than Tiberius was Caligula. And Tiberius had a terrible reputation. And I think it was a Ballantine, I can visualize it. It was a Ballantine paperback about the early days of the Roman Empire. And we had been at a Star Trek convention sitting next to Dorothy Fontana, and somebody said, what does the T stand for? And jokingly, I said Tiberius. because anything else would have been dull, you know, Timothy or Thomas and that. So I said Tiberius. Everybody had a good laugh, and we went on. We forgot about it. And then about a year later, we're doing the Star Trek animated series, and I was working on a script. I think it was Bam. And I said to Dorothy, can I reveal that James T. Kirk stands for Tiberius? And she says, I'll run it by Gene. And Gene said, okay. And so that was there. But then I also put it into a Star Trek novel I had written where somebody compared James T. Kirk to the Roman emperors and said, probably one of the Claudians. And somebody else said, no, probably more like Tiberius. So that was how he got his middle name. And so I had some fun with that. It was just I created that little piece of Star Trek lore. It started as a kind of tongue-in-cheek, but the more you think about it is to be a commander of a starship, you have to be a little bit of a dictator. And you have to be a little bit selfish, I think. So never having been in command of a starship, it's all speculation on my part.
So, David, the Tribbles were not originally called Tribbles. They had a different name. Can you talk a little bit about that and how they became Tribbles?
Yeah, I called them Fuzzies. Holly Sherman, my girlfriend of the time, had a fuzzball on her keychain, and I said, oh, those would be funny to – what if they bred and they got out of control? I was thinking of rabbits in Australia. And so I turned in the outline, a fuzzy thing happened to me, and Dorothy Fontana thought it was whimsical. She said, this one has whimsy. Let's give it to a real screenwriter. And Gene Okun, who had already met, said, no, I want to give the kid a chance. Let's see what he can do. And Joan Pierce, who was in charge of research, said, well, H. Beam Piper wrote a novel called Little Fuzzy, which I had read, and we don't want to step on his copyright, his intellectual property. Could you name these critters something else? So, and Gene mentioned it very casually, just come up with another name. So I went home and made a list of all the silliest words I could come up with and crossed off the ones that were too silly and was left with the word Tribbles. And I'm looking at it thinking, I don't know, all right, because it was the only word left on my list. I couldn't think of anything else. I went back into Gene Okun's office for a meeting about the rest of the script. And we were talking about the rest of the script. And in the middle of it, I said, oh, and we can call the creatures Tribbles and we'll rename the script The Trouble with Tribbles. And Gene said, okay. And that was it. There was no long conversation. It was just, okay. I had no idea that Tribbles were going to be iconic. And that, I mean, because the episode was aired on December 29th. And I had some friends from school over for a visit, and we watched it together. And afterwards, one of them was saying, oh, my God, David, this was so – in fact, it was Bob Englund who played Freddy Krueger. And he says, this was great. I had no idea you were such a talented writer. This was such a wonderful episode. And finally, I stopped and said, Bob, stop. It's only one episode of one TV show in 20 years. Nobody's going to remember it. Yeah, I have not been right about a lot of stuff, I guess.
Well, one more question before I turn my Trek experts loose. They're chomping at the bit to talk to you. This is something that this debate that goes on amongst Star Trek fans. What Star Trek episode is better, Trouble with Tribbles or City on the Edge of Forever?
Well, Harlan and I had a long talk about this, I think about 30 seconds, and we agreed that City on the Edge of Forever is a better episode, but Trouble with Tribbles is a more popular episode. And so he gets his credential and I get mine. And I'm absolutely willing to say that City on the Edge of Forever is a masterpiece of television. I watched it the first time and I remember being absolutely horrified and shocked and amazed and stunned by how well it was done. Now, the thing is regardless of Harlan's feelings about what was finally aired, because he was in some he had some upset about the rewrite. But if you've read his original script, it wasn't filmable. And Dorothy Fontana actually did the major part of the rewrite on it to make it fit into the Star Trek universe. And normally they would spend $178,000 per episode, which is a lot of money in those days. They spent something like $272,000 on City Under the Edge of Forever. So they went way over budget to make that the best episode they could, because they knew the script deserved it. And despite Harlan's complaints about the rewrite, I think the rewrite was a stunning job. Dorothy let Gene take the blame for many years, but she finally told Harlan a couple years before he died, says, "I did the rewrite." And by then he had mellowed enough that he didn't explode. Harlan was my big brother. I loved him. I loved him and Dorothy so much. I can't even begin to. There aren't words to express it. I learned a lot from both of them.
And we still love Trouble with Tribbles as well. And I am going to pass the mic over to Paul. Paul, all yours, buddy.
David Gerald, wow, I cannot believe this moment. This is very exciting for me. A lot of people love to fawn over actors. I tend to fawn over writers.
Me too. I will tell you there are a couple actors who I will go all fanboy with, and I had the privilege just a month ago of meeting two of them in the same place, the Gallifrey Convention in Los Angeles, the Doctor Who Convention. I got to meet Alex Kingston again, a second time, and because he starred in my favorite episode, The Husbands of River Song. But I also got to meet Sir Derek Jacobi, who I've been an enormous fan of since Claudius.
And incredible.
If you haven't seen I, Claudius, you must see it. It is one of the greatest miniseries ever made.
No, I'm a big fan. I love that. I love that series. Brian Blessed, I think, was even in that. I'll see anything that guy.
Brian Blessed, John Hurt, John Rhys-Davies, let me share this. A fellow named Patrick Stewart played a character named Sejanus. And in the offices of Star Trek, Bob Justman went running into Gene Roddenberry's office and said, "I found our actor for Picard. You must meet him. I want you to meet Patrick Stewart. He is the one who will play Picard." And he's so pushed. And so they brought in Patrick Stewart. And and Dorothy and I had been kind of agitating for a fellow named Steve Mott, who is absolutely a wonderful actor. But Bob Sussman pushed for Patrick Stewart, and Gene chose Patrick Stewart, who got the job specifically because Bob Sussman had seen him in I, Claudius.
Wow. That is, I've never heard that. That's fantastic, man. That's great. I love getting all the deep, dark details of history, my friend. This is fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you for telling us the keychain story about the key fob, because that was one of the things I wanted to ask you about, was how this came into being, like your initial inspiration for all this, right? Because I think of the first season of the original series as being so serious, right? And sometimes veering into melodrama. And I think a lot of us think of Tribbles as being such a comedic left turn. And I'm just, you know, I'm very curious to hear from you, like, what made you decide to go down a comedic turn like that? And how did they react to it at first? Like, the producers, the cast, what was that all like?
Well, I will tell you, the first season, Gene Roddenberry and Bob Justman and John Meredith Lucas were very, very focused on the gravitas of the series. And I think they were right. We had to believe in that starship. Otherwise, very quickly, it would turn into a kiddie show. And Gene's experience with World War II and with being on LAPD, and Bob Justman was a war vet. And they really wanted to capture that military gravitas. And I think there were some of the very best episodes from that first season are just wonderful because of that. But there's a thing that television needs where you have to lighten up once in a while, because you can't save the galaxy every week. Once in a while, you just have to let your hair down and have some fun. And my examples at the time were shows like Maverick and The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and Wild Wild West, where there's a lot of action, but every so often there would be a funny moment. And my favorite is in Man from U.N.C.L.E., where Ilya Kuryakin is bugging the planting listening devices in the yard of this villain, and the young woman who is sunbathing says, "Am I bugging you?" And he says, "On the contrary." And it's just a wonderful little, yeah. So Yeah, I mean, it just, and of course, Ilya Kuryakin, you know, had that wonderful dry delivery, and he's just such a good actor. I'm sorry I never met him. Anyway, so I was thinking Star Trek needs to lighten up a little. In the second season, Gene Okun was running the show while Gene Roddenberry was out on vacation, a much-needed break because he'd been pushing himself so hard. And he realized, and he said, this show has some whimsy. Dorothy Fontana said this has some whimsy. And so it wasn't as funny a script when it was just this a little light. And then we started putting in jokes as, oh, here's a place for a funny line. And D. Kelly said, suggested, now he tells me as a funny line. And somebody else suggested something. And I said, oh, that's fun. And we kept, we didn't realize what we were doing, but the show got, when we got to the final script, it was hysterical. You would read the script and you start laughing out loud, and it went to the soundstage, and the cast was delighted because they had all been playing so serious. It was, oh good, we get to have some fun. And Bill Shatner had been, you know, Shakespearean trained actor from Canada, and he had done Thriller, and he'd done Twilight Zone, and he'd done I think he did a Perry Mason, he did a Bonanza, I don't remember. He did a lot of stuff, and it was all very serious roles. And, you know, so, and in fact, I thought because he had played so serious that he wasn't going to let tribbles fall on him. And I was prepared to rewrite that where he steps aside and we could still make it work. And no, he wanted to do comedy. The man has incredible timing as a comic actor, and he'd always wanted to do comedy, and nobody had ever given a comic script. And so he just loved it. And you can see it, that he's just having a great time throughout the entire episode. And one of the things I did is I wanted to see what the rest of the cast could do. So I specifically wrote a scene for everybody got their page, because I wanted to see Nichelle do more than open hailing frequency. I wanted to see them have some fun. And because I thought Spock had been overused in the six previous episodes I'd seen, I downplayed Spock a little bit. And I apologized to Leonard for that later on. He says, yes, but I do follow Captain Kirk very well, don't I? And he understood what the writer was attempting. He was a marvelous man. And so... but Roddenberry came back from vacation, like on the last day of shooting Tribbles. I wasn't there. And he was very disturbed because he said Star Trek isn't a comedy. And he was quite upset by that for a while. And that was one of the reasons why Gene Okun left the show. It's because Roddenberry didn't want the show to be a comedy. But eventually, because Roddenberry didn't have what you would call a sense of humor that way. He didn't understand comic writing. He didn't understand that you needed the funny bits to contrast with your action. And the example, of course, is James Bond. Every time there's an action sequence, Sean Connery would finish up with a quip of some kind, like, well, like she's had her kicks, you know, and it gave you a release from the tension of the action, which is what, you know, you saw in Wild Wild West and Man from U.N.C.L.E. and Maverick and other shows, is they weren't afraid to have the comic lines. And Gene was afraid that if Star Trek became too funny, people would stop taking it seriously. But I think the comic episodes were a necessary break. But this is me being just a little bit arrogant. I don't think any of the other comic episodes quite reached the peak of Trouble with Tribbles, where the gags were so tied in with the threat that Tribbles represented. So that's my only arrogance. I don't think the other comic episodes quite work.
Entitled, my friend, because I have to agree
Thank
with you.
You.
I think it's a high watermark, and it's a touchstone for everybody. I mean, it's the adoring affection people have for that episode decades later. It's just everybody loves it so much. It's just such a great piece of writing.
I had somebody say to me one time, accuse me of, you've been living off Tribbles for 50 some odd years. And, well, yeah, if you ignore The Martian Child and The War Against the Tor and the Star Wolf trilogy and the 50 stories I've sold to the, excuse me, 100 stories I've sold to the various magazines and the tribute issue FNSF did and the this and the that and the Heinlein Award and the Hugo and the Nebula and the this. Yeah, if you ignore all that, yeah, I've lived off Tribbles for 50 years. But I want to point something out. is that remember the beginning of the Muppet movie where Dom DeLuise says to Kermit the Frog, you can go to Hollywood and make millions of people smile, and Kermit gets this look on his face, which is really hard with a puppet, because make millions of people smile. And that's what I have done with the trouble with Tribbles. I made millions of people smile. And if you have to measure my career by anything, I've made millions of people laugh out loud and smile. And 50 years later, more than 50 years, people are still pointing to it and saying, that's my favorite episode, or that's one of the great episodes. And I find this a little bit overwhelming, or even sometimes very overwhelming, when I stop and think of it in relation to everything else. But in terms of a career high mark, yeah, if you accuse me of living off Tribbles, I'd say, yeah, I've made millions of people smile. What have you done lately?
But it's so great, man. You were a pretty young man, as I recall, when the show came on the air. You were in your 20s, right?
Yeah, I was still in college. This is a fun story. I wanted to do a directing project as my senior project. They said, you got to graduate. You can't stay here forever. I said, well, okay. So you got to do a senior project. I said, well, I want to direct. And I said, no, you can't direct. They didn't have much faith in me. They said, you'll write something. I said, you don't have a writing instructor. They said, we'll find someone to grade you. Go do a writing project. And I really was like, you know what? I don't even care if I get the diploma at this point. And then my agent called and says, you have a meeting over at Star Trek. They want to buy one of your stories. So I went over and they bought The Trouble with Tribbles. And I wrote a whole book about that adventure, because nobody had ever written a book about how you sell a script to television, what the whole process is. But I had, at the end of the summer, I had like 3 outlines and 4 drafts of the script and God knows what, whatever paperwork. And I had a document that was easily 6 inches thick. And I bound it all together and I took it over to the school, and I walked into the office and I said, here's my senior project. And they looked at me and they said, what is it? I said, it's a script for Star Trek. They shot it last week. It'll be on in a couple months. Wait a minute, it's a script for Star Trek, and yes, I sold a script to Star Trek. Here's my writing project. And I went back, right? So, you know, they took it, and I walked out thinking, well, all right, you know, it wasn't good enough to do a directing project. And I heard later on a couple of people go, he saw the script, big deal. And somebody else said, you idiot, don't you realize he went pro, which is what everybody in the theater arts department, that was the goal. You would go in the theater arts department because you want to go pro. And so I went back a couple weeks later. I said, just checking, what grade did I get on my senior draw? An A, of course.
That's great, man. Can I direct now? Is it okay?
Yeah, well, actually,
now that
no,
I'm in the
well,
business,
the
sorry, I'd do it, but I'm just too busy now. Like, you've never stopped since, man. You've been working nonstop ever since then, from what I can tell.
Yeah,
I mean,
well, let me share this with you. About 20 years ago, the guy who ran the theater arts department, not the dean, but one of the guys who, the theater manager, I said, I have a play I've written. Do you think I could do it? And he took me in to see the dean, who had never met. And I said, I have this play. It's a 2-person play. And I really want to see if it'll work in front of an audience. And he said, well, if the kids from the theater guild want to do it, you can put it on here. So I checked with the theater guild. They said, yeah, we like this. And so we did some casting, whatever, and I directed a play called Uncle Daddy Will Not Be Invited, and we put it on with a couple of really talented actors, and the Theater Guild provided the backstage support, a stage manager and lighting and sound, and we put it on, and we got standing ovations every performance. And so I said, oh, good, I got my directing project, and based on the audience reaction, I get an A. And So I finally got to do my directing project at CSUN about 30 or 40 years later.
That's great, man. Well, you know, it's the best revenge, right? It's like no matter how much time's involved,
I was very pleased with the audience reaction. We had an enormous and a lot of my friends showed up, and Nichelle Nichols even came to one of the performances, and she gave the actors much praise. And I went out in the lobby after the first night, and one of the students was on his phone calling all his friends saying, there's another performance tomorrow night. You have to come and see this. So, which is, that's high praise indeed, because, you know, is when the students say, you've got to come see this show, it was pretty good. We had a lot of fun, and I stayed in touch with both the actors, and they're both remarkable man. In fact, they've both had pretty good careers since then, and I expect to see their names up in lights any day now.
Oh, that's awesome, man. That's awesome. I want to ask you one other question, David, before I pass it over to one of our other Trexperts here, because I know everyone's chomping at the bit. But I seem to remember, and this is my memory is a little sketchy over time, but I seem to remember it back in, like, I want to say it was in the world of Star Trek, that you had a lot of ideas that you were advocating for about how Star Trek could be different. And I've heard talk over the years that a lot of those got folded into the development of the Next Generation series when that was starting to come together. And I would love to hear what you were lobbying for the hardest, and what made it, what didn't make it, and what you were most passionate about. That's what I'm fascinated to hear that.
Gene was, 20 years older, and Captain Kirk had always been his avatar. And I realized, he said, David, I think you should write our series Bible, our production Bible for us. And I said, okay. And so I put all of my ideas into that production Bible. And of course I would run every draft by Gene, and he'd look at it and he'd make some suggestions. But most of the time he said, yeah, that works. Add this note or take that sentence out. So the production Bible is, I would say, 90% my ideas of who the characters were and how we were going to do the show. And so I think the thing that I was most interested in was the ensemble aspect of the show, that we would be able to focus on different characters. And so the goal was our captain would mostly stay on the ship and stay out of danger, and our first officer would be the away team leader, and that would give us two heroes to the show. And of course, if we had trouble with either actor, we could replace either one of them. Dorothy and I had stayed in, we were very best friends, and we had stayed in touch for, and we had talked about problems that were happening with actors on shows. And so, and we had put together a thing called the Star Wolf, which we pitched. Everybody loved it, but nobody wanted to compete with Star Trek. But we had discussed that in the Star Wolf, the actors would be replaceable. So we had a way to replace any single character at any given. Now, we had one role that we thought would be the hero of the show, and he would not be the captain. And the running gag was that we would replace the captain every three or four episodes. They'd die or transfer or whatever, so that you would never know who was the real star of the show, because we wanted to focus so much on the ensemble aspect. And we were having so much fun planning it. And there were a lot of different places that said, oh, yeah, we could do this. And Showtime was interested, and this was before Amazon and Netflix. But so we're going to the Showtime and HBO, and they all said, this is terrific. This is better than anything we've ever had the privilege of seeing. Sci-Fi Channel gave us some money to develop some scripts. And then either there would be a regime change of the executives in charge, or they would say, but, the Henson Company is pitching Farscape to us. If we have to choose, we have to go with the Henson Company. And the Henson Company was 10 years late in delivering Farscape to anybody. And we already had scripts and production documents and artwork. We could have hit the ground running on the Star Wolf. And it was just a great missed opportunity. But, Henson had the gravitas of look at all the movies they'd produced, and they had done Fraggle Rock and The Muppet Show. Like, so they had the production team in place. We would have had to start from zero, or not quite zero. And then the one time, and I will share this, Fox was ready to pick us up. They made an offer, and then the next day they withdrew it, and the day after that they announced they were going to do Space Above and Beyond with the exact same tagline that we had pitched, World War II in Space, as a shorthand version. And the next day, after withdrawing their offer, they announced they were developing it in-house, and we knew exactly what had happened, but we couldn't prove it. But we also knew the exec who had done it had a very unsavory reputation. So he had done that before to other shows. He wanted to... Yeah, it was a bad scene, and I'm sorry we ever walked into Fox.
Wow. Well, it seems like you've done a phenomenal job of not letting episodes like that taint you or make you cynical. You seem like you're just an incredibly positive force in science fiction literature, and you've had a remarkable career, my friend. So I'm just, again,
well,
it's a thrill to get to meet you. I would like to, I have to let you know, we do have another gentleman on our show, one of our Trexperts named David, so this could get confusing, but David is probably the biggest Tribble fan I've ever known in my whole life, and I think it's only fair.
Oh, my.
That David, you know, get to ask, take over the mic and spend some time with you next, if that's okay. But it's been a treat for me, man. Thank you, Mr. Gerald.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Cool. Hi. Welcome to the show. It's been really great to
talk with you.
Yeah. So.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. I just want to say it's really nice to meet another David who apparently also likes Tribbles. So,
Tribble's been very, very good to me.
Okay, cool. So you mentioned that you lost a few pounds. Do you gain pounds by eating those Tribbles at all? Or?
All the stress of living in Los Angeles, which was overpopulated, and we were having enormous challenges facing us. And selling the house and moving and, you know, buying a new house and moving everything. And Sean and I both gained weight, but and part of it was late night stress eating. Hmm. And since since moving to Vermont without the stress, much quieter, I was just watching the pounds drop away. And because we're eating healthier and we're not doing the late night stress eating. So I felt very good about that.
Nice. So you've also mentioned the inspiration of where you came about with the whole Tribble story, which is one of the questions I wanted to ask. But my next question was, did you get that inspiration from the idea that the little fudgies were there, but did that come along with, like, another thought you had, like maybe you were thinking of another TV show or have read something in a book or something, or is there something more deep?
Well, yeah, I'm fascinated by ecology and biology, and you'll see that in a lot of my books, especially The War Against the Tor, but also in Hella, is that I'm just fascinated by the way the biology fits together like this vast organic machine. And I had been fascinated by the fact that when the English moved into Australia, they were an ecological disaster with the prickly pears and the rats and ultimately the rabbits. And Australia has always had a volatile ecology anyway. And everything that humans do is almost more destructive. But the rabbits were the most obvious one, and I had read several articles about how the rabbits got out of control in Australia, and they had to fence things off, and blah blah this and blah blah, and so I started thinking, what if you had rabbits on a space station and they got out of control? Well, you couldn't do real creatures because you couldn't afford to do it, and the problems, you'd never catch them all at the end, right? And so I said, so it has to be some kind of critter that we can portray, and Holly had this little fuzzball on her keychain. I thought, yeah, that'll do it. What if we had little fuzzballs? And that was it. So I was thinking of rabbits in Australia.
Because of the increased population growth, I would imagine.
Well, yeah, that was the joke, is that the population gets out. They're cute. The rabbits were brought to Australia by an Englishman who thought, wouldn't it be nice to have rabbits to hunt, you know, because he'd had hunted rabbits in England, and you know, it's like, okay, but rabbits breed, and all you need is for two of them to get out of your, you know, fenced area.
Cool. So my next question would be, I'm very curious of who came up with the Tribble noise. How did that come about?
Well, I had said in the script that they had a purr. And we didn't want to use a cat purr because that would have been identifiable. And the sound department went off and they found a pigeon coo. And pigeons have just a very direct coo. But there's a way to warp a sound to make it, you know, stutter. And so what they did was they did a little trick with the sound. I don't know how they did it, but it's called a warped pigeon coo.
And that was the triple purr. And it really is a nice sound. I mean, you guys have been using it tonight. It's a great sound. Mm-hmm. And my buddy at TribbleToys.com sells tribbles. If you go to TribbleToys.com, you can find if you pick up those tribbles, they either shriek like you're a Klingon or they purr. And it's the actual sounds from the show.
Nice. Cool. Speaking of Klingons, I was curious, who came up with the idea that the Klingons had the Great Tribble Hunt?
That was not me. I think that was when they did the Trials and Tribulations episode. They wanted to address that particular aspect of Star Trek lore. And I think the Trials and Tribulations episode was brilliantly written, brilliantly directed, mm-hmm. brilliantly produced, brilliantly acted. It is absolutely, I think, one of the finest episodes of Star Trek ever produced anywhere. And I stand in admiration of everybody who is connected to it. And I have let them know over and over. The director was a really cool guy. I was an extra on that. And one afternoon, they had gone back to the original negative of Trouble with Tribbles and found it was in great shape, and they were able to scan it and restore it because they wanted to be able to match it. So they matched the lighting, the makeup, the set design, the original lenses, the film stock, everything. So they're running the episode to see where a certain scene will fit in the show. And they're running the tape fast forward, and there's this whole crew, the director, assistant director, and the lighting guy, and the DP, and the cast, and God knows who else. And they're all standing around watching as they're fast forward. And I'm in the back, and I said, "You're going the wrong direction. That scene is earlier." And they all turned around and looked at me and said, "Who the hell?" You know, they with the look on their face, "Who the hell are you?" And the director said, "Well, if anyone would know, David would. He wrote the episode." And they all turned around and looked at me with a different look on their faces. It was fun, and then they found the scene, and I said, "That's the scene," and then they went and shot the scene, and the director turned to me and said, "Do we have enough tribbles on the, or do we have too many?" And I looked and I thought, "Let me see. We just came from this. We're about to go to this." I said, "We have to put a few more tribbles in," and so me and the director were putting tribbles out in this one shot, and I said, "Oh, I just directed the director."
Wow.
But we had a great time. We had a great time. And at the end of the day, when everybody, let's thank David Tyrrell, because when someone leaves, they get applauded. And so I got applauded, and it was very nice. And to this day, I say it was one of the high points of Star Trek history is the repeat visit to the Trouble Tribbles.
Cool. Wow. I actually did not know that you were in the background character. Could you point out which scene it would be?
You'll have to watch. I'm the gray-haired crew member in the red shirt.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. So I think I just got one more question before I pass it on to next host. So Tribble idea and everything. I would assume that maybe you probably have a couple hanging around your house.
No, I don't. I have one. I have a baby tribble somewhere, and it's still in storage somewhere, but I did not keep in many of the tribbles because other people wanted them. And I will tell you this, when you're working as a writer in television, whatever, and you're raising a child, and my son is the greatest joy in my life, but there were times where we were tight for money, so I would auction off the tribbles or anything else I had. But I did keep the one little tiny tribble. That's all I have left. The others, there were times when I actually had to say, what's more important, feeding my kid or hanging on to all of this memorabilia? And I have been trying to live a minimal lifestyle life, so stuff that I have been collecting is now going up for later this year will be going up for auction because I don't need it anymore. It might be worth something to a fan or a collector now, and mostly books and stories I've written, manuscripts and file copies. We have a lot of stuff in storage because I used to keep large numbers of things, of everything, but my son and I had a talk, like I'm
I'm 80 years old. My son says, Dad, I don't want to have to do it when you're gone. I said, I'm not going to go anywhere. And he says, yeah, but we had to do it with grandma. And we had to do it with so-and-so. And I'm tired of having to clean up, you know, someone's estate. So we had to talk about what we're going to keep and everything, and we made up, you know, it's like, okay, you can have, we'll keep this and this and this, but we're going to get rid of that and that and that. So that's my project for the next 2 or 3 years is to downsize everything. So those who are collectors want some of my, you know, first editions of some of my books, there will be, you know, go to my Facebook page or my Patreon page, and I will be posting the auctions there when I start it, probably in a month or two. So,
oh,
but,
wow.
Yeah, I have a Facebook page. I have a Patreon page. And people who want to see more of what I'm up to, there must be a few in the world. There's the place to go.
Cool. Nice. So I'm assuming that the Facebook page, it's okay for you to say it on this radio show, I'm assuming?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you just look David Gerald on Facebook. You'll find me real easy. And, in fact, there's a couple other pages. There's one called the Other David Gerald page, and there's one that's my publishers have put up where you can order some of my books. And but the one that my most active page is the one where the cover photo is pictures of my family, my son and daughter-in-law, my grandkids. And I think there's not a picture of the dog. And then the Patreon page, www.patreon.com/David Gerald, is and there's no space between David and Gerald. That one has a photograph on the cover taken from the International Space Station by astronaut Jill Lindgren. Hmm. And he took a tribble to space, and he photographed the tribble in that a large port they have. And so here's a tribble floating in space, and beyond it you can see the Earth. And when he got back, he was visited him in Houston, and he gave me that tribble. And so I gave him a book of short stories that I had dedicated to him, which he was kind of gobsmacked by that. That book is called A Promise of Stars, which is mostly about exploring the solar system. So but I have a tribble. It is a tribble that spent 6 months on the International Space Station, and that has to be the single greatest award I've ever gotten in my life.
Wow.
And right now it's somewhere in storage, because when we had to move, I had to pack everything up, and we only unpacked the necessities. So only now am I starting, now that I've gotten half the stuff moved to Vermont, I can start going through those boxes and start looking for stuff. And I know I have to find my Hugo, my Nebula, and that Tribble, so I can have them on display again.
Nice. Cool.
And that baby Tribble I mentioned, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm going to go ahead and pass this over to our next host. I believe it's his name is Andy?
Oh, there's a Tribble
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
And or you have a Klingon on staff, too, I guess.
Oh. That would be our co-host.
That was me. So we're gonna introduce Andy right now. So Andy, you can step up to the mic.
David, hey, my first question is, which actor is your favorite Chekhov of all time, and why is it Andy Brake?
We did Blood and Fire, which you can find on YouTube as a fan film at James Colley's Star Trek effort, and Phase 2. And James and I talked for months about how to do it right, and we were on the phone almost every night, and the script grew very much, and he said, we wanted 1 hour. I said, nope, you're getting a Star Trek movie because there's just too much story. And but I'm going to direct it. I know I can make it work. And I did the shooting schedule. I said, if we can keep to the shooting schedule, we'll get it all done. And I arrived, and Andy Bray is just, I have to say, was just great fun to work with. We had a lot of fun. He has a great sense of humor, and we were just joking back and forth. And there was one blooper where he was complaining Well, all I do is just sit here. A potted plant could do my part. And then your camera pans away to look at somebody reaction shot, and then the camera pans back, and there's a potted plant sitting at Chekhov Station. And
that's
the kind of jokes. Yeah, and I just have the highest praise for Andy Bray, who's just a great guy to work with. And
I would love to work with him again. I'm going to stop you there, David. This is Andy Bray.
Now, well, shut up, Andy. Let me talk about you. What a great guy you are.
It's him.
I'm starting to blush here.
But I have more than once people, when we have been looking at the episode and people are asking about the cast, I say Andy was the most fun to work with. And not that anybody else wasn't fun. I mean, Bobby Quinn Rice and Evan and everybody, it was so much enthusiasm to do the job right that I was, as a director, I just felt it was a privilege.
And I got to say too, you were a great director. We had directors before who had struggled to get things done. Even folks like Mark Zucre, who had done George's episode, he struggled. Not because he didn't know how to direct or anything like that, but just because it's like being in a whole different world out there. He had made the mistake to try to shoot at night to avoid some of the noises, trains and such, but then got a whole new set of noises, and then everyone was sleep deprived, turned out to just be a mess. But I'll let you talk about it, but it's not like any kind of production you're used to. When you go out to Port Henry where we shot, and we were shooting in a auto dealership / like mechanic shop where James had built
this awful
set, and it's hot and there's flies and there's noises and we had the town had a charm about it, but it was also kind of like a Children of the Corn thing going on. And one year there was a grocery store, and the next year there was no grocery store, and the next year the grocery store came back. So we had like one grocery store sometimes, but there were three funeral homes in the same town.
I remember there were motorcyclists who made a point of riding back and forth. But you know what? What made it work was the enthusiasm. It was like, you know, I know we're going to have a lot of cleanup problems and editing challenges and whatever, but we were having so much fun it didn't matter.
And you made it fun. The previous shoot kind of lost its fun because we weren't gathering around the campfire and really enjoying ourselves together. We were just working and then going to bed in the middle of the day, and it was slowly exhausting all of us. And you kind of brought back a rhythm to it where it was go to work, do the job, you know, have fun at lunch, have fun afterwards, do campfire afterwards, that brought it back. And so I want you to kind of elaborate about the gonzo filmmaking of fan films for folks who don't know quite what it's like. You know, it really is kind of like the old saying, letting the inmates run the asylum. How did you prepare for it? Was it what you expected? Was there anything that caught you off guard?
What caught me off guard was the absolute commitment of everybody, because nobody wanted to be the fuck up. Everybody wanted to be the guy who delivered their job and made it Star Trek. And the first couple of days, we were running late every night, 2 a.m., and I called a meeting early on the third day when Keith Dameron finally arrived. He was my assistant, my unit production manager. And I said, look, we got a choice here. We can either do Star Trek camp or we can make a Star Trek movie. And if we make a Star Trek movie, y'all have to be here at 8 in the morning ready to go, and I promise you we'll be out of here early enough you can get a good night's sleep. And when I put it that way, I think everybody got it, that what we were doing was we were being a real movie crew instead of just fooling around. And that was, you could feel the shift in what everybody's commitment was from that moment on. And all of a sudden, everything started to fall into place. And it was really a remarkable experience because I understood one thing from having been on multiple sets, is that it is about morale, and the director is the one who establishes that sense of morale. So we would be waiting while somebody sets up a thing, and I'd holler out, who knows why it's called MOS? And nobody would answer, and I'd explain mid-out sound was from the German director who mispronounced without sound, and so MOS became mid-out sound. And I would do trivia questions like that throughout, so people knew that I wasn't some kind of, you know, a monster who was expecting everything to run like a machine, but more like that we were a team having fun together. And once we established that particular context for what we were up to, everything flowed a lot smoother because people knew they were there to have fun and make a Star Trek movie. And I think James Colley has said more than once it was the most fun shoot he'd ever had with Phase 2.
I second that. Yeah, anyone who thought at first that, oh, David Gerrold must be a diva, he's been, you know, the golden boy of Star Trek for decades, he's going to come here and we all have to bow down before him, I think that was dismissed right away. I mean, you were very approachable and very fun. And there was, speaking of goofy little photos we took, there's one that I think I got somewhere on my computer of me getting directed by you as you're reading Directing for Dummies, the book.
Oh, yeah. I had, that was one of the gags, is I had printed out, I had a copy of some book, and I had printed out a phony cover that said Directing for Dummies. And so, yeah, I know the photo. I love it, too. And so I had wrapped that false cover around a book, and I'm pretending to read it and pointing to you, you know, like I'm taking notes out of the book. And it was just a fun moment. And because I just wanted to let people know that we're not, you know, I had heard that because people had had a bad experience with the previous directors, oh, God, what am I walking into? You know, people are going to be afraid that they're going to have to do that again. I said, no, I got to have, we're going to have fun. So,
yeah. It was a great icebreaker, and I think it set the tone marvelously. Now, I got one more question before I pass it along, and one statement before that one question, just something I wanted to tell you. I couldn't tell you back then because I wasn't married back then, but I'm married now, and this is true. My mother-in-law's maiden name is Tribble. Honest to God, that's
true. Wow, it's been like, funny. Woman.
Yeah, talk about a small world. But my question, now that we're talking about New Voyages, and I guess I'm the perfect guy to ask you about that since I worked on it, I wanted to talk to you, give you an opportunity to talk about Blood and Fire, about its inception back during Next Generation, about the difficulty in getting it made, and then about how you were approached to make it as a fan film, what that was like to finally get it done, and in getting to bring gay characters onto Star Trek at a time when one fan film had done it before, but none of the real Star Trek had done it yet, and what that was like. I know personally we got some blowback from some of the close-minded people on talkbacks, as they tend to do, but I think overall we got inundated with people who were thrilled about it.
Well, Gene had promised it in front of an audience of 3,000 people. So a fan asked, when are we going to see a gay character on Star Trek? And Gene said, it's time. And this was before we even knew what we were going to do on Next Generation. And then in a staff meeting, it came up, and Gene said, Gene bawled out Bob Justman and said, no, we're going to do this. And so I was very enthusiastic, but I hadn't thought about how to do it or when or where. And then I heard that there was a blood donorship crisis because of AIDS, and because of my friendship with Robert Heinlein, who has his life had been saved by blood donorship. And so, you know what? We can do a story about blood donorship, and at the end of it, we put up a card that say, you can be a Star Trek hero, donate blood now. And I thought that would be a great way, because the next day, you know, when 5 million people show up to donate blood, we not only end the crisis, but we show the power of Star Trek. And that was my goal. And then as I'm working on the script, I realized, oh, wait a minute, these two characters could be gay. Well, wait a minute. All right. So Riker says to Freeman, he says, how long have you two guys been together? And Freeman responds, since the Academy. That's it. That was the only reference. But every gay person in the world would get it, that these two guys were together. And not only that, all those young gay men and women who watch Star Trek would say, I'm not invisible. There's a place for me aboard the Starship Enterprise. And so I knew that it was important. And then I turned in the script, and Dorothy Fontana and Bob Justman were for it, but we had a bunch of people who were, I don't know, there's no polite way to describe the response. And Rick Berman said, oh, we can't do this. You have to take them out because we're going to be on at 4 in the afternoon in some places. And mommies are going to write letters. And I wrote a memo in response to that saying, great, it shows they're watching the show. They'll tune in next week to see how we're going to offend them. Because that's, and people stuck their head in my office and said, that's a great memo, but you still have to take it out. Now, it occurred to me last week, I could have realized, I could have turned those two guys into clone brothers and the same actor could have played, okay, I could have saved that script, right? But I was so committed to the, I said to myself, I cannot work for hypocrites because we made a promise to the fans. We did it in front of the audience. And if we don't keep that promise, my memo said, if not now, when? If not here, where? And Rick Berman, when he got in charge of the show, said, we will never have gay characters on Star Trek. He was, that was his, he issued that as an edict. And that was a betrayal of everything Gene had promised. And so I left, right? And I forgot about it. I put it behind me. And because I went home and Gene's lawyers started spreading rumors I was hard to work with. So I couldn't get any work for a long time. I couldn't even get an agent for a while. And so I said, no problem. I am going to go write the books I want to write. And I realized, you know, I'm working at home. And my life works. I'm making enough money. The house is in good shape. I'm going to do something I've been dreaming of for a long time. I'm going to adopt a little boy. I wouldn't have been able to do that if I had been working full-time for Star Trek. I wouldn't have been home. I said, I'm writing at home. I'm going to adopt a little boy. And it seemed like a good idea at the time, right? And I applied for adoption and was approved. It took a while, but I was approved, which surprised me and everybody else. And I met the most wonderful little boy at a group home, and we just hit it off brilliantly. I fell in love with him almost immediately. And I said, I'm going to take this kid. And I would not have been able to be a dad. That kid would not have had a dad if I had not been there. And I should send a thank you note to everybody who kicked me off Star Trek because I got a better life. I was writing better stories because I was writing for myself now. And and then one day, I guess it was about 2006, Dorothy calls me and says, you've got to answer the phone when James Colley calls. I said, it's just the fan stuff. She said, and talk to him. So James Colley called and we started talking and he says, I want to do Blood and Fire. I says, okay, but we're not going to, you know, we got to do the gay characters. Otherwise, he says, oh, no, we're going to do more than that. We're going to have them get married. We're going to do the whole marriage thing. I said, okay, I'm on board. And so James and I talked almost every night, and I was passing him notes, and he was passing me notes. And we finally, the script grew organically, and I was absolutely delighted with the casting and the acting and the fact that I had the creative control that to make it work. And there was some pushback from fans. We got one fan complaining, I'm all for diversity, but it has to be normal diversity. I was like, I put my head in my hands on that one because I don't know.
Yeah, but, really?
But once we started showing it at some of the conventions and once it would, if people started to get it, that if it's okay for Captain Kirk to sleep with a green-skinned woman, why are you having an issue with two men expressing their affection for each other, for being in love with each other? It is time that we actually accepted that the range of human experience includes same-sex relationships. And I think it was one of the most courageous things that we did anywhere, because we said, look, this is Star Trek, but we're going to live up to the promise that Gene made 20 years earlier. We're going to do the Star Trek that was promised, that the way things are is not the way they have to be. And I will tell you, we had a lot of fun with it, too, because there's that scene where Bobby Quinn Rice asks James Colley, will you perform the marriage ceremony? And Colley, as Kirk, turns to Spock and say, am I the only one who didn't know? And Spock says, I think Mr. Scott was too busy.
It's a very Star Trek line. Yeah, it's kind of a fun Star Trek moment.
I think that the recreation of that whole Kirk-Spock-McCoy relationship was one of the strongest parts of that whole adventure.
Yeah, and they... We introduced gay characters into that group, that ship, and it didn't explode. The world didn't end. And right there, I think that was enough proof to some people that, yeah, so what? What's the big deal? And some people just needed to be able to see.
Yeah, and now we live in a culture, a context where, oh, somebody came out of the closet. That's nice. You know, it's like, I don't even care anymore who comes out of the closet. They can be whoever they want to be. I don't care. And there's gay relationships on just about every TV show except perhaps The Bachelor. And I believe there was a spinoff of The Bachelor, which was about a gay relationship. So it's become so commonplace. Nobody even raises an eyebrow anymore unless they are so far off the rails that they're not quite rational.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple right-wing pastors who have gone on at length saying that they think gay people should be executed or deported or whatever. It's like, yeah, nobody's not going to happen.
Yeah, that's the fringe loonies now. Now, I think everyone else is on board with it's not a big deal. Well, David, thank you, and it's been a pleasure catching up with you. I'm going to pass it on to one of the other Trexperts here.
Oh, thank you, Andy. It's always fun talking with you.
Thank you.
All right, Charles, you're up next, buddy.
Okay, well, David, I'm actually going to take part of your last comment and add a question to it. You mentioned about doing some work for Next Generation. Well, I'm curious what went into doing the novelization of Farpoint.
Oh, well, I'll tell you the story in that. I didn't do it. Dorothy Fontana had been promised a novelization, and she had written it. And Gene's lawyer was a vile human being. I think he was human. he might have been a Vogon or something. He was just one of the most – I have never met anybody in my life who struck me as evil down to the bone. And he admitted he enjoyed hurting people. And after she had written the book, and there was only 2 weeks to go before the deadline, he took it away from her. And he came to me and he said, David, you're going to write the Star Trek novelization. And I realized, well, I could do it in 2 weeks, but I don't really want to. I got other things I have to. And I went to Dorothy and I said, let me get back to you. I went to Dorothy and I said, if I don't do it, somebody else is going to do it. Give me your manuscript. I will turn it in as mine, and I'll give you the money. And she agreed. That way she would get the money. So I went back to the lawyer. I said, yeah, I can do it. And I took Dorothy's manuscript and sent it off to the editor, and he said, can you do a bit of a polish on it? And I had enough time to do like 5 pages at the beginning. And he said, we don't have any more time. Just give me the book. And so Dorothy said, you're going to take some of the money because your name is on it. I said, okay, but you have, you know. So Dorothy got the bulk of the money, and I got my name on her book. And I the lawyer never found out that I had done this. But Encounter at Farpoint was written by Dorothy Fontana, that was something that I did specifically because she deserved to get that. She deserved to get paid for it, if nothing else. And actually, she should have had her name on the book. But when I write my autobiography, which is going to be called, if you had wanted me to say nice things about you, you would have treated me better. but if and when I ever write that autobiography, I will talk about what a great person Dorothy was. And what a vile walking elbow of a human being the lawyer was. A walking elbow wrinkle. So, I mean, he was just, and there are no photographs of him. No camera survived the attempt. So he's just a vile human being. And I will tell you a story. I get a phone call from Dorothy Fontana, and she's laughing like crazy. And Dorothy was not what you would call a demonstrative woman. For her to laugh, I knew something was up. I says, what's so funny? She says, Leonard Maceless, that's Gene's lawyer, has a brain tumor. It's like, I was speechless for a moment, partly because of Dorothy found this funny. And my reaction was, should I send a get-well card to the tumor? That was how much we both despised the man. He had set out, he had done so much damage to people who loved the show that he pushed me off the show, he pushed Dorothy off the show, and eventually he pushed Bob Justman off the show. And one day Gene Roddenberry was alone in his office crying. Richard Arnold told me this, that Gene was crying. Where are all my friends? I've lost all my friends. What happened? I don't have any friends anymore. And, of course, all of his friends from 20 years had been pushed away by the harm that Leonard Maesler had done. And I felt bad for Gene in that moment because he never understood. He had been told he had to treat his friends as enemies, and the result was, oh, I'm your enemy now? Okay, well, I guess I'm just going to walk away. And I will tell you, that hurt all of us. That really hurt all of us because, you know, we wanted Gene to be a winner. We wanted Gene to have everything. We loved Gene. We wanted him to have everything he deserved. And we felt cheated of the opportunity to be a part of his success, and he didn't even get to enjoy his success because he lost all his friends.
Jeez. No.
Wow.
No,
I don't like telling that story. I honestly don't like it because, you know, Gene gave us Star Trek, and he was a visionary in many ways, and he gave us a great TV show. He had his flaws as a man. We all have our flaws. God knows I've kept mine secret, but we all have our failings, and Gene, he was prey to the bad input he got from some of the people around him. So, and I'll leave it at that.
Well, we appreciate the story, though. How was it? Okay, you're doing Trouble with Tribbles. Then they come to you and say, well, we want you to do more Trouble with Tribbles.
Yep.
So what was it kind
we
of
We were going to do that.
Go ahead.
We were going to do it as a third season episode. And then Gene left because of a disagreement with NBC. And Freddie Freiberger's first words to me were, I just screened Trouble with Tribbles this morning. I didn't like it. Star Trek's not a comedy. Well, this endeared me to him immediately. So I just, all right, we won't do more Tribbles for Star Trek. Okay. Even though Gene had previously said he wanted another Tribble episode, it wasn't going to happen. And then in 1974, Filmation was going to do the animated Star Trek, and Dorothy was producing it. And she called me and said, will you do more Tribbles, more Troubles for the animated Star Trek? And I said, sure. I would have said yes, no matter what Dorothy Fontana asked. And so for the longest time, I did not think it was my best work. I did not think it was as good a script as the original. But I screened it last year just to see – you know, because people were talking about it and I hadn't seen it in a while. I said, you know what? This holds up a lot better. It's a suitable sequel. And, you know, if we had been able to do it live, excuse me, I've been talking, my throat is dry. Hang on a second. If we'd have been able to do it live action with the original cast, I think it would have ended up being as silly and as fun as the first one. But as an animated show, it still worked out. We're still able to make it work.
Definitely. Well, I think I'm going to throw in one question that I'm surprised our host didn't ask. But what got you into writing one of the Planet of the Apes books?
Oh, that's kind of a fun story. I had been living in New York for a couple years, and excuse me. And I had sold a bunch of stories to Galaxy Magazine, and they were one flight down was award books. And one day, one of the editors walked upstairs and said, we need somebody to novelize the Planet of the Apes movie. Can you recommend someone? And Judy Lynn Del Rey said, oh, yeah, we're working with this young guy named David Gerald who knows his way around the script. He would and he's fast. He'd probably be a good one to do it. So they called me and called my agent. And I said, yeah, I can do it. send me the script. And I looked at the script, and here was like 100 pages. And I said, all right, now they needed 200 pages of manuscript, something like that. And I said, all right, so I have to take each page of script and write 3 pages of description. And I figured, let's see, I have 2 weeks to do it, because that was a very tight deadline. And I said, all right, so I have to do X number of pages a day. And I sat down and just started typing. And I started having a lot of fun describing things and putting in a couple in-jokes here and there, and just for my own sake. And I said, but I'll do this, but I want to be an ape when they shoot the movie, because I'm doing a column for Starlog. And they said, I think we can arrange it. And there were some phone calls back and forth. And they said, okay, you go out to the 20th lot, the ranch out in Gora, and you can be an ape. And it takes 3 hours to put on the makeup. And I was in the chair next to Roddy McDowell, but he would show up early and then fall asleep. And they'd wake him up. He was 3 hours later. He was an ape. So I was not going to wake up Roddy McDowell so I could chat with him, even an enormous big fan of Roddy McDowell. So I got to have my makeup put on next to him, but I never had a chance to talk to him. But I did the book, and then they said, well, they went back and said to my agent, your guy did such a good job. Is he available to novelize the other 2 books we have? And my agent said, no, he's too busy, which I'm kind of annoyed by. It wasn't a lot of money, but I would have been happy to do them. And they gave them to Jerry Cornell, who he did a fine job. And Jerry and I were good friends, and we had some good arguments too. I think Jerry Cornell was a remarkable man in many ways. Anyway, I turned in the book. They were very happy with it. I got some other novelizations later on. I did Enemy Mine, and I think, I don't remember. I think I did one other, but I don't remember. I novelized a couple of my own scripts. Death Beast started out as a script and became a book. Novelizing it can be easy, it can be difficult. It depends on the project. If you're given something that really sucks, it's like, how do I make this work? But if it's a really fun project, it's like, oh, I'm just having a great time working on this.
Yep, that's why.
You're still there? Are you still connected?
Yep, I'm still here. That's why I was curious about the PowerPoint book. So I'm going to pass it over to Eric, which is our caboose, for some more questions.
Hey, okay. David. Yeah, thank you so much for hanging on in with us. It's been super interesting to hear all the stories that you have to tell. The one thing that I don't know if you've ever been asked that I'm super interested in is, do you just think about Star Trek all the time? Because I know
no.
I do.
No.
Do you think about stories all the time? Or are you constantly creating?
I'm always thinking about the next book or the next story. In fact, I just finished a 37,000 word novella, which I just sent off to Analog. In fact, the current issue of Analog has a 45,000-word novella called Ganny Goes to War, which has gotten some wonderful reactions. I'm very proud of it. And I hope Trevor, the editor to Analog, likes this one too. And I'm already thinking about the next one. I have a 30,000 words on another novella that I want to finish up and get out of here, and then I can go back to work on the novels. I'm always thinking about the next story, or how do I fix the one currently in like, I'll get tired. I'll go to bed instead of falling asleep, my mind says, oh, don't forget this. And you also want to add that. And oh, you can expand on this. It's like, even when I'm trying to sleep, my mind is writing. So, the only time I think about Star Trek is when guys like yourself start asking questions, or when I've been invited to do another Star Trek tour in Ticonderoga on April 13th. And anybody who's listening, and if you're close at all close on the East Coast, come up to Ticonderoga, New York. I'll be doing a tour at 10 in the morning and 2 in the afternoon. And we have a lot of fun, and then we sit around the bridge and we watch the screening of the Trouble with Tribbles with my commentary on it. So, and I will tell you this: even if I am amazed by the Star Trek set tour and all of the things they have on display, I know that the fans will be even more amazed.
Oh yeah, for sure. I've actually had the privilege to be out there and actually be on the set tour myself, and it is something to behold for sure. Are you in touch with new Star Trek? Are you watching, you know, Discovery, Strange New Worlds, all that stuff?
I actually know, and I know they're doing good work, and I know a lot of people have said, oh, you've got to have a look, and et cetera, et cetera. But, like, here I am, I wake up and I start writing, and then I take care of the kids, and then we run errands, and I come back and do some more writing, and then I have to go out and empty the dog, and, you know, and then we have to worry about dinner, and then my writing time starts around 7 in the evening and goes till midnight, and to actually watch something on TV doesn't happen, because
yeah.
I would rather be sitting in. If I'm going to sit down and watch a movie, it takes 3 nights because it's like, okay, I've watched an hour. That's as much as I can do right now.
That's so interesting. So you get more stimulation from actually producing new content than you do from consuming content, which I think is different from most Americans, right?
There's a lot of movies and TV shows that I do want to catch up on. I had a great fun watching Monarch, Legacy of Monsters. The one that I found most fascinating is called The Offer, which is about the making of The Godfather and Albert Ruddy and Francis Coppola and incredible. And they've recreated the feeling of the original Paramount and the cast, whatever, marvelously. And there's other things that I want to, I love this stuff. But as somebody who has a responsibility to keep writing, it's like, do I want to watch? And like, there was a movie I started to watch this afternoon. I was taking half the day off. I started to watch it, and halfway through, I realized this movie is dreadful.
Mm.
And I don't care. You know, I have a 3D TV, so I'm watching it in 3D. And I say, I don't even care if it's in 3D. It's just, I don't need, it's like, I'm a third of the way through, and this is embarrassing. I am never going to watch the end of this. Which for me, to actually walk out on a movie is, it's like I could not find one redeeming quality of the entire movie to continue watching it. So, which is an act of to actually say I'm not going to finish this is big for me. And I won't identify it. It's an old movie.
As you go forward, do you feel a responsibility as a steward of so many of these things to, pass judgment, but just like, provide input on what's going forward
I idolized Dorothy Fontana and mm-hmm. Harlan Ellison and Robert A. Heinlein and to some extent Theodore Sturgeon and definitely Samuel Delaney and all of the other authors, Annie McCaffrey, Joanna Russ, all of the other authors who were so good to me and helped train me, Harry Harrison and Fred Pohl, especially Fred Pohl, that they were my role models and they were the standards, they set the standards of excellence. And they were just very important to me because almost all of them were standards of integrity as well. And I should mention Larry Niven and Jerry Pornell as well. It's not just good writing, but a level of integrity about the human adventure. And I want to be worthy of that. Whatever legacy I have, I want people to say that I not only wrote good stories, but I lived up to the integrity of the characters, that the integrity of the characters was a reflection of my own feelings about our responsibility as human beings.
Uh-huh.
And so when we talk about Star Trek, I think it's important to remember the Star Trek ambition, the Star Trek dream, the Star Trek idealism that, as Gene said more than once, the way things are is not the way they have to be. And he would say, I want you to write the story that sticks in your craw that nobody else will let you write. He could inspire writers when he would give that speech. But I also feel that we didn't accomplish as much as we could have and should have, and to a great degree it's because the Star Trek The Next Generation, a lot of promises were made that we didn't get a chance to live up to. The studio made some promises, you don't have a network, you have more freedom, you have this, you have that, and then we weren't allowed to live up to it, and then Gene's lawyer appointed himself chief of staff, and he wasn't there to make Star Trek, he was there to protect Gene, which I certainly don't object to, but he would wander the halls like this monster telling people, oh, that's aesthetically displeasing, you can't do that. And we didn't know what we could do anymore. And then he started hiring other producers. All of a sudden we had people who didn't understand Star Trek and we had to educate them. Oh. And so I think it's important for fans to understand, don't accept all this as canon. Some of it is sheer desperation of trying to make it work in an unworkable situation. I'll give you an example. We got the go-ahead on October 10th, and I said to Gene, we have a six-month head start. We could have all our scripts ready to go on the day we start shooting. We could have our whole season planned. And all that time got pissed away on all of the internal stuff that went on, so that on the first day of shooting, even the first script wasn't finished. They were shooting episodes without the scripts.
Wow.
Weren't ready.
Wow.
All that time, we could have done so much more if we had been given the freedom and the direction, and if Gene had been up to it. Gene's health was failing. And there were people who took advantage of that.
Huh. Yeah, that's...
I believe that Star Trek represented a vision, and it was up to us who were custodians of that vision. It was up to us to live up to it. If we were going to speak it, you know, not enough to talk the talk. You got to walk the walk.
Yeah, and I think if you go into the TNG years, nobody would say that episodes that you were involved with didn't do that. And I'm very excited about the fact that in the future, hopefully you get to discover some of this new Star Trek that's going on, and I'd love to have you back in, you know, a couple of years after you have a chance or something to look at it. Because
let me say this.
They
have my phone number.
They have
my phone number. If the phone rings, I'll answer it. If somebody from Star Trek calls me and says, David, we think it would be a good thing to have a Star Trek emeritus writer involved in the show, would you come in and yeah, I would say, yeah, what do you want to do? What do you want me to do? Where's the ambition? And I'd be aboard. I would certainly be willing to come back. But Gene's lawyer had declared that I'm an enemy of Star Trek. I don't know if anybody at Paramount still hews to that vision that I'm an enemy of. I'm not. I'm one of Star Trek's biggest fans and biggest supporters. I would love to come back if I were invited. But in the meantime, James Colley and I are talking about what can we do with the we have these Star Trek sets. We have people who want to shoot some stuff. What can we do? And he came up with an idea that we're talking about. And I don't know how to make it work yet, but he's enthusiastic. So it's like, I love the challenge of how do I make this work? Because what he is suggesting here is so ambitious and so incredibly important that it's like, okay, I'm going to sit and find a way to make it work. And I love that kind of a challenge. I don't know how to make this work. What am I going to do with it? Uh-huh. So James Colley and I are talking about possibilities.
That sounds super exciting. I can't wait to hear what comes out of that because I think there's some good stuff going on up there in Vermont. Do you, David, have any obviously you've been around for a very long time. Do you have any favorite projects that you've done throughout your career, like things that you look back on and you say, you know what, that's the one that I'm really proud of?
Well, yes. Thank you for there are several that I'm very proud of. I am very proud of, obviously, The Trouble with Tribbles, simply because it has made it such an impact, and it's still watchable all these years later. I'm extremely proud of The Martian Child, the novella I wrote and later the expansion, the novel, because it was written from the heart. It's really a love letter to my son. It's how much I love my son. What an enormous difference he made in my life. I have said to people that commitment to adopt a little boy saved two lives, his and mine. And now he has a beautiful and talented and intelligent, wonderful wife and two beautiful children. It's like none of that would have happened if I hadn't said, yeah, it seems like a good idea. So, The Martian Child. And then I would also point to The War Against the Tor, which I am going to finish. But there's another story I've written called 13 O'Clock, which you can find on Amazon, or you can find the expanded with the two sequels. 13 O'Clock was a breakout of the box big time and create a new voice and tell a story that was so far beyond anything I'd ever attempted before. It is, there are people who say this must have been written by somebody else because this isn't a David Gerald story, but it is a David Gerald story because ultimately, and I was stuck in the middle of it, and I suddenly realized this is a love story. And when I realized it was a love story, and there was an insight about love in the middle of that story that is heartbreaking, that's what made the story work. And I sent it off to Gordon Van Gelder at FNSF, and I said, here are all the reasons why you shouldn't buy it. It's violent. It's sexual. It is practically unreadable because the hero is illiterate. He's passionate. He's brilliant, but he's illiterate. There's all the reasons why you shouldn't buy. And I said the only reason why you might consider buying it is it's one of the best things I've ever written. And,
that's
like
great.
About a week later, the check arrived in the mail, and we got. Four people canceled their subscriptions, and one of them sent the magazine back in shreds, which I was disappointed because I was expecting a mob with torches and pitchforks. But it's one of the more ambitious and remarkable things I've written.
Wow.
I very rarely brag, but I will tell you this: I think that is one of the few times I came close to the quality of storytelling that Theodore Sturgeon or Harlan Ellison demonstrated regularly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's some great names to drop. I mean, there's no question that you've, along the way, sort of wanted to push that envelope a little bit and been stopped at certain points along your career, but then been able to realize that at certain points in your career. So I just think that's so...
Uncle Harlan was my role model.
Uncle Harlan, I love it.
and Dangerous Visions, where he said, and he was saying the same thing that Gene was saying, the way things are is not the way they have to be. Let's kick out the boundaries.
Yeah.
And that became my working mantra for writing. And the big day was, I was in 1972, I was living in New York, and I was working on The Man Who Folded Himself, and I said, what if Mom reads this? And I suddenly said to myself, I don't care if Mom reads this. I have to, and that was a liberating moment. It's like, I don't care who reads this. This is what it has to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, was a turning point, is that I never again cared about the reader response if it was going to get in the way of what I was going to write.
So are you writing for yourself versus other people? Like in general, throughout your career, or
Well, there's this thing that happens where you start thinking about the audience more than you should, and you start thinking about how is this going to play, and that was what happened when Rick Berman said, oh, we can't do this as gay characters because mommies will be watching the show and they'll be offended. I was like, no, that's the whole point here, is that we were promised the opportunity to do, you know, and it's like Star Trek is supposed to be the first to break ground, not the last.
Mm-hmm.
And that was always my attitude, is a story should disturb the comfortable and comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And once I understood that stories were supposed to break the boundaries and move, you know, I mean, you know, you read books like Brave New World and 1984 and other books that break the boundaries, and it changes the way you think about writing. And I want to be that kind of a writer. I don't want to be the one who turns out multiple copies of one slice off, another slice off the same old sausage. And I realized I was doing something the Beatles were doing, They never wrote the same song twice. Every time a new Beatles song came out, you had to grow up in the 60s to understand it. Every time a new Beatles song came out, it sounded different than every previous Beatles song. Uh-huh. And I wanted to do the same thing. I never wanted to write the same story twice. I always wanted it to be a surprise. And if people say, there's got to be more than one David Gerald writing this because these are not the same, that's great. It means I'm succeeding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I'll say that in terms of my love of Star Trek, the ones that I love, the episodes that I love the best are the ones that have no right answer. They're the ones that like ask questions but never actually come to a conclusion. That to me is amazing.
I wanted to do that with the Cloudminders, where McCoy says at the end, yeah, it's going to take a while to solve this problem. How many children are going to die in the meantime?
Think about
it. We never got that far.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's good. That's good stuff. Oh, my gosh. David, thank you so much for coming on our show. I'm going to pass the mic back to Jim, but it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, David, we have a caller on the line that wants to talk to you.
All right.
So let me get me today.
By the way, are you recording this? Please send me a copy of the recording because I forgot to turn on my recorder.
Oh, yeah, no problem. It's online, brother.
It's there.
Okay, thank
Hello.
You.
Hello. Are you there, caller?
How you doing, Jim?
I'm doing good. You're on the air live with David Gerald. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I do. Hey, David, it's TJ Green.
Oh, hey, how are you?
Not too bad. I was actually calling to ask you because when I rewatched Scribbles, I just noticed like all the different comedic bits and then the mystery of it and the mild action and the comedy within that of that whole bar scene. Did you have any like comedic inspirations when you were kind of writing the script? Like, you know, like for some reason, like say they were inspired by like Second City or SNL, like that kind of thing?
Well, yeah, actually there were a lot of moments where I was thinking in terms of great comedy and in the bar scene. There's a famous bar fight. I think it's in Destry Rides Again. And so I wrote in the script, this is the greatest bar fight of all time. It's Destry Rides Again. They're all, you know, and of course I knew we didn't have the budget for it, but I wanted it to have that kind of a feeling. And Joe Pevney, who directed the episode, understood exactly. I didn't block it out in the script because your stuntmen and your director, and I just said it's a great big brawl, director and stuntmen will figure it out. But that was based partly on this great bar brawl that I from that great old Western Destry Rides Again, which you must see because it's got Jimmy Stewart and Marlena Dietrich, and it's a great movie. And and there's a couple other places where, you know what, if you feed a tribble too much, well, that's a Mary Poppins reference. If you feed a bird too much, you know, you get fat birds. What if you feed a tribble too much? Fat tribble? No, you get more tribbles. So it's there were lines of dialogue that were suggested by previous experience with, and D. Kelly came up with Now He Tells Me. So, yeah, a lot of the comedy in it is based on proven comedy. There's a thing called a triple where you do A, B, and then C is the punchline. It's like there must be hundreds of thousands, 1,771,561. That's a triple. And so everything I knew about writing comedy went into that script. Everything I then knew about writing comedy went into that. Now I think I know a little bit more now. But, yeah, I had studied comedy because if you can do comedy, you can do drama. But if you can do drama, that's not a guarantee you can do comedy. Drama is hard. Comedy is impossible. Is that what they – no, dying is hard. Comedy is dying is easy. Comedy is hard. Whatever. I don't remember the quote. But, yeah, if you can do comedy, you can do anything. And there are comics like Milton Berle and Edwin and others who proved they were great dramatic actors when they were given the roles.
All right. And thank you for calling, TJ. We appreciate that question. Guess what, David? We are out of time.
Out of time.
Yeah. I got to tell you, I will drive up to your house and help you go through your vast collection and decide what, you know, what you want to keep and what you want to sell.
Hey, send me a message on Facebook. I need transportation to some of my appearances, and if you are anywhere in the neighborhood and want to spend some time driving me around the Northeast, I'm looking for a driver.
Well, you just found him because I'm about 35 minutes north of you. So,
oh, how wonderful.
Yeah.
Great.
All right, well, you know how to reach me.
You know how to reach me.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I just wanted to take an opportunity to say thank you so much, so much for spending some time and Trek talking with us. We really, really appreciate that.
Oh, I had a fun time. Thank you for thinking of me.
And my Trek experts, you guys want to say thank you to David?
Thank you, David.
It's a pleasure, man. Thank you for all your hard work and being so neighborly.
Yeah.
Thank you all. This was fun, and maybe we can do it again sometime.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you for being a great guest.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We got to talk about Planet of the Apes next time, for sure.
I don't have much to say about it, but I'll be happy to say what I know.
All right. Thank you very much, David, and you have a great night.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right,
guys, we're going to be talking next week about 80s sci-fi, and Eric won't be with us, so we're still going to try to get through. I want to take this opportunity to say thank you so much to the one and only Andy Bray, Mr. Chekhov himself, for hanging out and Trek talking with us tonight. Thank you so much, Andy.
Absolutely. Always my pleasure to talk to Mr. Tribbles himself.
And there he is, Mr. Chekhov, making an appearance. Thank you so much. And thank you so much to David for talking with us. Thank you, David.
Hi, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me on the show.
It was fun. And thank you so much to Paul for hanging out with us. Thank you so much, Paul. Okay, and thank you so much to Eric for hanging out and Trek talking with us. And enjoy your vacation, by the way.
Thank you so much. I'll miss you guys. Bye.
And thank you so much to our very own, our very own Charles for hanging out with us. Thank you, Charles.
Oh, thank you. I knew you hit some out of the park. Yes, this one, you went even beyond that.
Yeah, and I'm going to be driving him around, so how cool is that?
Yeah.
Can I get on some of that action?
Driving Mr. Gerald. It's a new movie. I love it.
Uncle Jim drives David Gerald, so yeah, that'll be cool. And, of course, I want to say thank you to our caller, TJ, for calling in as well. And I believe that I want to send a huge, huge shout-out to the one and only Ray, who's down in the Bronx. I saw Ray on the line, but I couldn't get a chance to get him on the phone tonight. So I want to say thank you to Ray for calling in and listening to us anyways. And we'll definitely get Ray on next week. And I'm your most excellent host, Uncle Jim, saying to everybody, please stay safe and be good to each other. Hailing frequencies are closed. Good night, everybody.
Good night, all.
Good morning, prosper.
Night, y'all.
Vasvidanya.
Vasvidanya. I love it.
I shall leave you as you left me, as you left her, marooned for all eternity in the center of a dead planet, buried alive.
Hello, you have reached the Q Continuum. We are unable to get to the phone right now because we are busy living in a plane of existence your feeble mortal minds cannot possibly comprehend. Furthermore, it's pointless to leave a message because we, of course, already knew that you would call, and we simply do not care.